And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I'm your host, Mark Gillar. We've got two great guests lined up today. In the latter part of the show, we'll be talking to David Murray, who is the son of Madeline Murray O'Hare, perhaps the world's most famous atheist. But first, we are pleased to have on the show for the very first time, Mallory Factor. He is the John C. West Professor of International Politics and American Government at the Citadel. He is a Forbes columnist, and he is the senior editor of Money and Politics for the Street. He's here today to talk to us about his brand new book, Shadow Bosses, Government Unions Control America and Rob Taxpayers Blind. Mallory, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Listen, I am about halfway through the book, and I am loving it. I get sent a lot of books from publishers, and for instance, I've got three authors coming on next week. I can't possibly read them all, but I can tell you this. I am going to finish your book.
That's kind of you. A lot of people think it's a novel, even though it's nonfiction, because it's full of violence, secrecy, corruption, coercion, feather bedding, special favors, backroom deals, and indoctrinating our kids nationwide.
Well, you know, you say it sounds like a novel. That opening scene did sound like a novel, like something straight out of the old Soviet Union. Share a little of that with our listeners, the healthcare meeting that took place behind doors that weren't so transparent.
Well, didn't you remember that the president said that anything to do with healthcare was going to be on C-SPAN? Isn't that what he said?
Yeah, and somehow I didn't see this meeting on C-SPAN.
I didn't either. The only thing we know is that going into this meeting, the big union bosses were grumbling about the health Obamacare, and they had been very strongly for Obamacare during the transition. Matter of fact, we have memos from the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, Dennis Rivera, going to Tom Daschle, who headed the transition team for the president on health care, saying how great Obamacare is going to be for the unions. Anyway, they go to this meeting, this secret meeting on January 11, 2010, and they come out of the meeting totally behind Obamacare. And what transpires, we don't know because we weren't there. We just know who was there. It was the president. And it was all the shadow bosses, the heads of the government employee unions and the big unions that have government employees. And no staff, no anything. But afterward, they put all their political clout, they put all their money, their efforts behind getting Obamacare passed. What they do get out of this meeting, we find out later, or what they get out of the president, is a 7-year deferral of their Cadillac plan. They're fabulous plans that their members get. And they had a 7-year deferral on having to pay money because of it. It cost the taxpayer $120 billion, but be that as it may, the real question is, and a real secret is, why did they put so much effort behind it?
Well, I know in life most people view things from a WIFM standpoint, a what's in it for me standpoint. So what was in it for the unions?
Well, Mark, you asked the big question. 21 million healthcare workers that could potentially be unionized. Less than 10% of healthcare workers today are unionized. This is going to be one of Barack Obama's second-term gifts to the unions in return for their crucial support. What happens is that in a number of states, 10 already, people who get money from the state are able to be unionized in 10 states already. And what happens under Obamacare is a lot of healthcare workers, many more, will be getting money from the state. And what will happen is they will be able to unionize a huge number of those people. So nobody really understands what's going on, but what really is going on is the unions are going to get millions of new members, and a lot of them are going to force into their paying dues, because in 22 states, once you're unionized, you have to pay dues or you can't keep your job. It is just horrific, and it's a scam on the American public and on the American worker.
Now, I'm in Texas, so I don't know a whole lot about unions, and one of the things you point out in the book is a lot of people say, hey, I'm in a right-to-work state. This stuff doesn't affect me. We don't even have unions here. What would you say to those people in right-to-work states who think that this doesn't impact them?
Nonsense. First of all, in every single congressional district, including the one you're in, the unions have something called a Uniserv director. It's a political operative getting paid $175,000 a year, plus a big expense account, plus a car, who are there to help unionize or get people elected to local boards of directors, city councils, without you even knowing it. Now, you happen to be in one of the great states, one of the free states, Texas. Mm-hmm. But believe it or not, there are 23 right-to-work states, and in 16 of them, you are forced under collective bargaining. Forced to be under a union's collective bargaining to keep your job. Right to work, just first of all, only applies to the private sector. And when you talk about government employees, it doesn't apply, but it usually follows. But you are forced under unions to keep your job. Therefore, in 16 of the 23 right-to-work states, unionization is about 60% higher, even though you don't have to join a union to keep your job or pay a union, but the union is your interface between you and your employer, the government.
So essentially you lose your rights to negotiate your own deal.
More than that, you lose your right to even talk to your employer. Any grievances, anything that has to do with your employer has to go through the union. And of course, the union's going to represent you if you don't join them the same way as if you did join them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they've always been really magnanimous that way. Nothing petty about those guys. One of the things that they tout as an Obama accomplishment is that he saved the auto industry. Was he there to save the auto manufacturers or to protect the unions?
He was there to protect the unions. This guy's our union label president. Who are we kidding? He is what he is. He is the union label president. He has deep union roots going back to Chicago Local 880 of the SEIU, Service Employees International Union. You know, that Local 880, that's the infamous local that was tied in with ACORN, that organization that had to disband itself for doing all sorts of bad things.
Yeah.
So, no, he's tied in with the unions. It's amazing how tied in he is. He's given government unions more access to the White House, more kickbacks than any president in history. He's handed money to them through stimulus bills and other spending, given them greater control over the federal workplace, unionized tens of thousands of new government workers, reduced scrutiny of their finances, and he's going to give them even more if he's given a second chance with a second term.
Okay, you're saying the stimulus was a payback to the unions. Are you trying to tell me, Mallory, that paying the unions millions and millions of dollars to train people for green to train people for green jobs that don't exist was just a payback?
I'm not going to say it was just a payback, but I'd say 90% of it was a payback. And in Shadow Bosses, we show how this all operates. We show how it moves, how the money moves from the unions to the politicians, back to the unions, back to the politicians. Let's face it. The unions put well over $500 million into his last campaign. And that was cheap for what they got. That's one of the best investments anybody could have made because they got so much more. They got multiple billions.
Now, there have been some complaints coming from the unions about Barack Obama not doing enough. Would you say he pretty much has that smoothed over at this point?
Mark, you asked one of the most important questions, and your listeners are going to be lucky that you asked that question because very few people understand what's going on. What's going on is real simple, Mark. And in Shadow Bosses, we show this in great detail. What's going on is president knows quite well that union issues are not polling well in the swing states. To get reelected, he needs the swing states. So with a wink, wink, and a nod, nod, he has basically told the unions, we're going to low-key it till after the campaign. In about 47 days, you're going to see this president's true union label stripes. He stayed away from the Scott Walker recall reelection. Even though he was in Minnesota, he could have shown up in Milwaukee or Madison and turned out a couple hundred thousand people.
Mm-hmm.
But he was willing to sacrifice that to be able to get his reelection. This campaign is very smart. Do not underestimate this campaign.
So,
they know what they're doing.
So Mallory, just like when he told the Russians, hey, hang with me till after the election, I'll have more flexibility, and when he told the gun rights people, or actually the people that want to ban guns, you know, we're doing some things under the radar, bear with me, this is the same thing he's doing with the unions. Hey, when that second term gets here, we can go hog wild because, you know, I won't have to worry about being reelected.
You're absolutely right, and remember how the unions were complaining they weren't going to support the convention in Charlotte? I was at both conventions, the Republican and the Democrat. Had media credentials. I was not participating as a delegate at the Democratic one. But you saw the unions low-keying it.
Uh-huh.
Except in meetings, Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, one of the shadow bosses, like the name of her book, was saying that we're going to have $500 million for him, and we're going to have 400,000 people on the streets for him, you know, volunteers, or as I like to call them, paid volunteers.
Right.
So, they grumbled and they made it look good because they know the swing states are vital to his reelection.
One of the things you point out in the book, Mallory, is that the private sector unions have been declining for 60 years, but the public sector unions are on the rise. Public sector unions really represent the future of unions, don't they?
Sure, and there's even a future beyond that. The fact is that if you push an employer in the private sector and you push them too much, you're going to force them out of business. But if you make outrageous demands in the government area, and you get those outrageous demands, you're not going to put the government out of business.
Mallory, I'm up against a hard break. We're going to step away for just a minute for a few messages, and then we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
And if you'd like to learn how you can get a solar generator for your family, just go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on the appropriate ad. While you're there, you'll also see ads for solar ovens, extended life light bulbs, and life-saving survival food packets.
Are you worried about the economy? Have you ever wondered if the politicians and the bankers are going to bring the whole thing crashing down? If so, pay close attention. Because in an economic meltdown, non-hybrid seeds could become more valuable than even silver and gold. After all, securing a source of food for your family is the single most important thing you can do. Introducing the Survival Seed Bank, the perfect mix of germination-tested non-hybrid seeds. You get enough seeds to plant a full-acre crisis garden that can produce an endless supply of nutrient-dense food for you and your family. And the best part is that these seeds have not been genetically modified in any way. Remember, in a real economic crisis, non-hybrid seeds are the ultimate barter item. Prepare your family today.
Prepare your family today by going to teapartypowerhour.com and clicking on the ad for the Survival Seed Bank. Now, while you're there, you're going to see ads for a lot of other products that can help your family in the event of a disaster, whether the disaster is government-made or natural. You're going to see ads for things like solar-powered ovens, solar-powered electrical supplies, and freeze-dried food that can provide your family with immediate nutrition in the event of an economic meltdown. Once again, the place to go is teapartypowerhour.com. And we are back with Mallory Factor. He is the author of a brand new book called Shadow Bosses, and he's explaining to us how the shadow bosses from the unions really run things behind the scenes. Now, Mallory, you mentioned in the book that we are headed toward a tipping point, if you will, where the country is going to have more takers than givers when it comes to government money, and that once we hit that tipping point, we'll be, you know, sort of past the point of no return. Talk to my listeners about that and how unions tie into that.
Well, they keep making government more expensive and larger. It is just shocking. And even the liberals, I've been on a few liberal programs with liberals, and they even admit at this point that the money's not there for the programs that they want. I want to see deficits reduced. I want to see the size of government made smaller. They want to see programs like Head Start and food and all these other programs, but the money's not there for either of us. For me to see our deficits reduced or for them to have their big programs, because the government unions are sucking out so much. And they're bankrupting, literally bankrupting, our cities and our states.
I was just about to say we've kind of been discussing this within a federal context, but it's certainly true at the state level and at the local municipality level. There are a lot of people out there, and particularly the problem with unfunded union pensions. I mean, my goodness, I can't even imagine what that bill's going to be when it comes due for the baby boomers.
It's huge. And our politicians, and we're not talking about Democrats, we're not talking about Republicans, we're talking about both. That's why your listeners are so vital to saving America. They keep kicking the can down the road, and that's wrong. It's wrong for our country. It's wrong for our children. It's wrong for our grandchildren. It's not going to be wrong for our grandchildren, because it's going to be long before our grandchildren. We are at the brink of falling into that abyss. It is, and in Shadow Bosses, we try to show this. By the way, if your listeners go out and get a copy of Shadow Bosses, and we hope every one of them does, when they're done with it, we hope they give it to a legislator, give it to a member of a city council, give it to a state legislator, give it to a mayor, because they need it, because they're not smart enough to listen to your show, Mark, in a lot of cases.
I think, yeah, definitely in a lot of cases. I've had a few of them on the show, but I don't think they listen. I'm not even sure they listened to me while they were here. One of the things that you talk about in the book is how unions come in and take over, and violence is certainly one of their tools. Let me share something from an email I received from a listener. She said that her husband went to work at a tire factory, and he was told, you know, you've got to join the union. And he said, well, what if I don't? And they said, well, we'll slit your tires and put sugar in your gas tank. And he noticed within a couple of days that some other guys who said they weren't going to join the union had their tires slit and they had sugar put in their gas tank. So he said, hey, guess what? I think I'll join the union.
Sure.
She said that when these people go on breaks, that the management has to run out into the parking lot and, you know, sort of herd them back in to the building, because when they go on breaks, a lot of times they don't come back. You have to go out and find them. She also said that any time they've spent too much time on breaks or they're just kind of sandbagging it, not doing their jobs, if management would say anything, they would break a very, very expensive piece of equipment, sometimes multi-million dollar pieces of equipment, in order to show management that they didn't like to be pushed to work harder. I mean, these are tools of the trade for union thugs, are they not?
No, it's much worse than that. Much worse than that. At least 203 Americans have been murdered, and at least 5,869 Americans have been injured in union-related violence since 1975. Let me give you a case that just took place this past summer. SEIU, Service Employees International Union, was was on strike against HealthBridge Healthcare Center in Danbury, Connecticut. It's a healthcare center. It has some people in it. It has a memory unit. It's a hospital, basically. They removed, for their strike, they removed wristbands from more than 30 hospital residents. They switched the names of patients in a memory care unit. They changed names on patient doors and wheelchairs. They removed feeding instructions, and they tampered with medication records. That's just heart-wrenching. And we go into this in Shadow Bosses. And when Trumka, who's head of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, was head of the United Mine Workers, a non-union contractor named Eddie York was shot to death when the United Mine Workers went on strike. People who attempted to save him were beaten up. And Trumka boasted 2 months later, and this is a direct quote, "I'm saying, if you strike a match and you put your finger in it, you're likely to get burned."
One of the things you point out in the book, Mallory, is that the way the laws are written, if union members commit crimes, but it's done in the name of furthering the union cause, then usually there's no penalty.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of these. It took the case for those lawyer types who are listening is U.S. versus Edmonds, and it was in 1973. Group of electrical workers fired high-powered rifles at three utility company transformers, drained the oil from transformers, and blew up a substation. Pretty bad stuff, right?
I think so.
The court decided that their acts were not wrongful use of violence, and they couldn't be prosecuted under federal extortion laws because they were in furtherance of, and I quote, legitimate union goals, these goals being the improving of the outcome of a strike. Wow.
Yeah.
Congressman Paul Brown introduced the Freedom from Union Violence Act in 2012 to fix this problem at the federal level. No Democrats have volunteered to co-sponsor it.
I wonder why.
This guy's a really good guy. Paul Brown, B-R-O-U-N. He's a Republican from Georgia. Let me change that. He's a Tea Party type and a conservative from Georgia who runs as a Republican.
Gotcha.
I just want to make that real clear.
That's important to my listeners.
I thought it would be. He's a good guy, and there's a couple guys like him. Louis Gohmert from Texas is another guy like him.
I met him at a meeting. He was open. He was the opening speaker for both Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin at a place called the Oil Palace in his district, and I like what I heard that night.
I'm actually going to be seeing him a couple of days, and he's one of the best guys possible. And if you'd like him on your show, I'm happy to ask him to, because I think your listeners would get a lot out of him, and we love him. He's just terrific.
Sure. Yeah, I like.
You get the truth to your listeners, which is really important.
Somebody's got to do it. Now, one of the things I want to ask you about is the future of unions. You kind of alluded to this earlier when you said, you know, in some states they will tax anyone, or not tax, they will try to recruit anyone who gets government money. Are we really headed toward a United States where food stamp recipients are unionized and Social Security recipients are unionized and people on disability are unionized?
Yes. Yes, yes, and yes. Remember, the NEA, National Education Association, which is the largest union in the country, and the teachers' unions, by the way, take in $2 billion a year just in dues, a lot of which they use for political purposes.
Sure.
Remember, the NEA was just an association of teachers, kind of like the AARP. And they morphed into a union. Well, you're looking at already AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, has something called AFSCME Retirees. It's 250,000 dues-paying members, Social Security recipients.
Mm.
So, they're looking for newer and greener pastures to get more and more dues money to be able to control more of the political process. I mean, the public... the private sector, they know they can't do much in any longer because they've killed it in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
The government employee unions, they have over 40% union under union control, 41%.
Compare that to the private sector for my listeners.
Oh, the private sector is 6%. 5%. I mean, it's small. 5% of all workers are five and change are members of unions in the private sector. I mean, it's just shocking because it doesn't work. I mean, this isn't Norma Rae, and this isn't Bud Fox. Remember Wall Street from Blue Star Airlines? This isn't it anymore. I mean, you have so many. You have OSHA, all this government regulation. Forget it. The sweatshops don't exist.
Yeah.
They're not serving that purpose, that useful purpose. But anyway, they see these new frontiers. And the new frontiers are anybody who gets money from the government, they want to unionize. Food stamp recipients, Medicaid recipients, parents under programs with dependent children, Social Security recipients, Medicare recipients, veterans. This is the new frontier. Here's the big secret, and we show this in Shadow Bosses. Every million new members is $1 billion that the shadow bosses can use.
Mallory, does it seem like a major contradiction to you that Democrats that don't believe you should have to identify yourself when you vote are also for union card check?
I mean, that's a pretty obvious one.
Yeah, I know, but I just wanted to...
Card check is basically getting rid of secret ballot elections. We think that you could clear up a lot of the union problems if you just allowed people to vote every 3 years, every 2 years, every 4 years, we say three, on a secret ballot if they want a union or not. Because only 7% of union members ever voted for or against a union. When they get their job, if they're in the 22 forced due states, they got to pay the union and join the union, or they can't keep their job. I mean, that is just so wrong. And the shadow bosses, we try to show how this actually operates and how the money moves around. 75% of all the money these unions take in come from the forced due states, those 22 states and districts.
We are actually out of time. I can't believe it. But let me repeat this again for my listeners. I'm about halfway through the book. We have a lot of authors come through, and a lot of them have written very good books. But I almost never use the term must read. I'm going to use it today. Shadow Bosses is a must read for anyone who wants to understand why this country is going broke and for anyone who wants to understand what they can do about it. Go out to your bookstore and grab it. Get it on Amazon. Do whatever you have to do to get a copy of it. But Shadow Bosses is a must read. Now, very quickly, if I've left anything out, tell the folks where they can get a copy of it.
Barnes & Noble's, Amazon, all fine bookstores. But when they're done reading it, please, please get it to a legislator because they need it more than you. They don't understand this, and a lot of them could not vote like they do if they really understood what they're doing to our country.
Fantastic. Mallory, thank you for being here today. Love to have you back sometime.
Love to come back. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mallory. Have a great day. Don't go away. We'll be right back with William J. Murray, the author of My Life Without God, right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
And if you'd like to learn how you can get a solar generator for your family, just go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on the appropriate ad. While you're there, you'll also see ads for solar ovens, extended life light bulbs, and life-saving survival food packets.
Are you worried about the economy? Have you ever wondered if the politicians and the bankers are going to bring the whole thing crashing down? If so, pay close attention. Because in an economic meltdown, non-hybrid seeds could become more valuable than even silver and gold. After all, securing a source of food for your family is the single most important thing you can do.
Introducing the Survival Seed Bank, the perfect mix of germination-tested non-hybrid seeds. You get enough seeds to plant a full-acre crisis garden that can produce an endless supply of nutrient-dense food for you and your family. And the best part is that these seeds have not been genetically modified in any way. Remember, in a real economic crisis, non-hybrid seeds are the ultimate barter item. Prepare your family today.
Prepare your family today by going to TeaPartyPowerHour.com and clicking on the ad for the Survival Seed Bank. Now, while you're there, you're going to see ads for a lot of other products that can help your family in the event of a disaster, whether the disaster is government-made or natural. You're going to see ads for things like solar-powered ovens, solar-powered electrical supplies, and freeze-dried food that can provide your family with immediate nutrition in the event of an economic meltdown. Once again, the place to go is TeaPartyPowerHour.com. And we are back at the Tea Party Power Hour with William J. Murray. I actually said David Murray in the first half of the show. I apologize for that. He's here to celebrate with us the 30th anniversary of his book, My Life Without God, which is his account of growing up the son of arguably the most famous atheist in the world, Madeline Murray O'Hare. Mr. Murray, welcome to the show.
Great to be on with you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when they told me you were going to be on, I got really excited because as a child growing up, I remember this legal action, and I can recall hearing about it in church and, you know, our local priest referring to your mom as our sister in Christ, and we would actually pray for your mom and pray for your family, and to actually talk to you now is almost a little bit surreal, to be honest with you. Talk to me, before we dive into the book and the legal action that made your family famous, what was it like growing up in a household that was run by atheists?
Well, it was more than atheism. And the atheism didn't cause the family behavior. The family behavior in history caused the atheism. This was a horribly dysfunctional, multi-generational of dysfunctional family. And my mother was kind of the end of the line of this. She could not hold down a job. She had severe personality problems. She was chronically unemployed. We lived in a situation where there was no father around in the 1940s, 1950s. This bizarre of a family was just totally unheard of. It was just very unusual. There was no the two illegitimate kids with different fathers. That just didn't happen then. We lived with our grandparents, with my grandparents, with her mother and father, because, as I said, she could not hold down a job. There was alcohol in the home. There was violence in the home. There were knives being pulled. There were dishes flying through the air. There was constant profanity. My uncle, her brother, who my mother's brother, who lived there as well, was marginal and, spent most of his whatever income he got on pornography. So this was a bizarre home, and the atheism came out of that. My mother was recruited into communism from the unemployment lines, where most communists or Nazis are recruited.
Literally, someone walked up to her while she was in the unemployment line and said, "Let me show you a better way."
The socialist and communist literatures has been passed out at unemployment lines for 100 years. This is where it's done. We in the right, we have this weird idea that socialists and communists are recruited on the college campuses. That just really isn't true. I will grant you that there are liberal arts programs where they don't study anything but being a nutcase. But most of the people in college just swallow hard and listen to all the baloney and because they want their degrees in order to go make a decent living. Traditionally, the hardcore of the communists, the socialists, the Nazis, the Black Panthers, the Ku Klux Klan, wherever you want to go, has been out of the unemployment lines. And this is where you find your people that are hostile to the system, that have difficulty surviving in the system, and that believe that somehow if you change the system, they're going to be better off. And the communism led to the atheism, but that isn't even what led to the school prayer case. The atheism didn't. It was really the communism that did it.
Gotcha. Now, I know in the book it states that you feel you were used as a pawn in this legal action. How was it explained to you that this was going to take place and that it was going to be about your rights?
Well, it was a little bit more complex than that, and it goes back to the communism. My mother actually believed all the Marxist dogma, and she was, among other things, associated with the Socialist Workers' Party, the Communist Party, the Fair Play for Cuba, the whole anti-war movement, which was financed by the KGB, part of the demonstrations in that. And she actually believed all of the rhetoric that came from the Soviet Union. We had a magazine, which I have a souvenir issue of was called USSR. It was later changed to Soviet Life. Big, beautiful color magazine that described the utopian life of the workers' paradise in the Soviet Union. And in 1960, she packed me and my brother up, and she attempted to defect to the Soviet Union, to this workers' paradise.
Wow.
They didn't want her. Of course they didn't want her. I mean, first of all, they didn't want anybody that ever lived in a free country, just as a starter. The only reason they took Lee Harvey Oswald is he got off the airplane in Moscow and refused to go back. They told my mother, you know, she got us as far as the Soviet embassy in France, somehow thinking that her heroic efforts to get as far as Paris, that the Russians were going to pay her way to Moscow and give her a place to live and give her a job and educate her kids. I could go on and on, but I won't.
My goodness.
It was typical utopian collectivist thought, which, by the way, and I know it's a Tea Party hour, and I love a lot of Tea Party people, and I love Tea Party people, but they don't understand the problem, none of them. Utopianism is the philosophy that would be. Utopianism is the problem. And my mother was a utopianist. Adolf Hitler was a utopianist. Stalin was a utopianist. Karl Marx was a utopianist. Mao was a utopianist. Anybody that has caused great death and destruction has been somebody who is a utopianist that believes that that can be achieved through centralization. It really isn't the Democrats. It isn't the college crowd. It's the utopianists, and it's that utopianist philosophy. And I think once the Tea Party and the conservatives and the Republican Party can actually understand the enemy and the logic of the enemy, we can actually start to get something done. And I'm not really trying to be down on the Tea Party because I love it, and I have people that work in this organization that are with the Tea Party. But it's that utopianist mindset, that collectivist utopianist mindset, that has caused so much death and destruction, particularly through the 20th century. But anyway, they rejected my mother. She told her go back and work for Utopia in your own country. We got back to the United States.
Bill, if I could just interrupt for a second. When you talk about the utopian philosophy, are the leaders of these socialist movements really utopian-oriented, or are they using the utopianism in order to lure people in the way you use bait to lure people into a trap?
They're collectivists. They're centralists. Anybody that's read Hayek really understands that. And people read Hayek, and for the for the wrong reason. Yes, he was an economist, but if you really actually read all of The Road to Serfdom, you can see that it is this, the collectivist philosophy, the idea of man-created utopianism is the driving force behind this. Do people believe this? Yes. Nancy Pelosi absolutely believes that she and Barack Obama are so smart that they can create a utopia in which everybody is equal, everybody works hard, and everybody gets fantastic benefits from a centralized society. They believe it.
Well, when you were mentioning your mom's belief that she would go to Russia and she would get this fantastic job and her children would be educated for free, I heard almost those same words coming out of the mouth of an Occupy Wall Street person not more than 3 months ago. And so, yeah, that belief is still there, and you've kind of enlightened me here today because I, you know, being a Tea Partier, I'm focused on the communism and the socialism aspect of what the other side is doing, but never really considered the utopian aspect to it.
Well, so. all of those things you mentioned are part of utopianism, and people that read Hayek seriously in study, and what he talks about is how the Frankfurt School of Economics and the centralization of Germany under socialism, just greased the skids for national socialism. And, you know, it's this centralization, and it doesn't matter. This is not new. This didn't start with Karl Marx. I mean, Thomas More, when he wrote Utopia, which he wrote in Latin, the book Utopia, he wrote it as a parody. People take this book seriously. The original book was a parody, and he was a Catholic, a devout Catholic, and it was a parody of Protestant collectivism that was sweeping Europe. And many of the first settlers that came to this country came because they thought that they were going to create a collectivist utopia under Christendom. And it can be traced back to the time of Sun Tzu, who wrote The Art of War, when a Chinese emperor looked at all these little rice paddies that were owned by individuals and said, oh, we can get much more food if we just if the empire controls all of this and the emperor owns it, and we'll give out equal patties, and everybody will have the same size patty, and we'll manage it, and we'll have twice as much rice, and half the population of China died underneath his rule. This isn't something that came out of Karl Marx. This is a recurring human idea that is just contrary to the gospel, contrary to the concept at its base, it believes all men are good. But I kind of don't want to get into the philosophical aspects of that. But I do highly recommend those who have not read Road to Serfdom not to just read the Heritage Foundation excerpt, which centers on economics, but to, download it for a few bucks into Kindle from Kindle or Nook or something, and really read this and study it, go over it, and look at the things that people have highlighted, and then go read the original Thomas More's original Utopia, and things start to really fit.
Well, I'm going to have to do that. You know, I'm always looking for an excuse to buy another book anyway, as evidenced by my large pile of receipts from Barnes & Noble and Amazon, so I will do that. Now, I hate to have to do this right now, but we're going to have to break away for a couple of minutes to do a little business with America, and then we will pick up right where we left off when we come back with author William J. Murray. He's here today celebrating the 30th anniversary of his book, My Life Without God.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
And if you'd like to learn how you can get a solar generator for your family, just go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on the appropriate ad. While you're there, you'll also see ads for solar ovens, extended life light bulbs, and life-saving survival food packets.
Are you worried about the economy? Have you ever wondered if the politicians and the bankers are going to bring the whole thing crashing down? If so, pay close attention. Because in an economic meltdown, non-hybrid seeds could become more valuable than even silver and gold. After all, securing a source of food for your family is the single most important thing you can do. Introducing the Survival Seed Bank, the perfect mix of germination-tested non-hybrid seeds. You get enough seeds to plant a full-acre crisis garden that can produce an endless supply of nutrient-dense food for you and your family. And the best part is that these seeds have not been genetically modified in any way. Remember, in a real economic crisis, non-hybrid seeds are the ultimate barter item. Prepare your family today.
Prepare your family today by going to teapartypowerhour.com and clicking on the ad for the Survival Seed Bank. Now, while you're there, you're going to see ads for a lot of other products that can help your family in the event of a disaster, whether the disaster is government-made or natural. You're going to see ads for things like solar-powered ovens, solar-powered electrical supplies, and freeze-dried food that can provide your family with immediate nutrition in the event of an economic meltdown. Once again, the place to go is teapartypowerhour.com. And we are back at the Tea Party Power Hour, visiting with William J. Murray, the author of My Life Without God. He's here today helping us celebrate the 30th anniversary of his book. Now, when we left off before the break, we were discussing some books that you felt everyone should read. I think we talked about The Art of War, The Road to Serfdom, and Thomas More's Utopia. Did I leave anything out?
No, that was about it.
Okay.
And of course, The Art of War I mentioned in passing because it was the time, but More's Utopia and is very unique, and particularly if you get one which discusses why he named, has a foreword or afterword that mentions why he named the various characters what he did, because it makes it more, I mean, the name of the Latin name of the river that runs through Utopia means no water. So, you know, once you understand how much of a parody this is and that he wrote it as a parody on the Protestant collectivism that was, sweeping through Europe at the time, and you realize how far, people realize how far ahead this was of Karl Marx, you start to understand the depth of the utopian idea. And it's funny because it's people that can't make it and people that don't have to make it are always the ones that are attracted to this.
You know, Bill, as I read the book, one of the things that struck me was that it's just as relevant today as it was when it was written 30 years ago, perhaps in some ways even more relevant. What are your thoughts?
Well, the interesting thing is how much the society is changing. That's what I think that the book does. One of the reasons it is the 30th anniversary of the book, but it's also the 50th anniversary of prayer and being removed from the schools, because the actual case was in 1960. And just to go one step back, it was my mother's return from the Soviet Union. And what I discuss in My Life Without God in the book is the walking down that hallway in the school when she goes to re-enroll me, because she's brought me back late. I'm enrolling late in the junior high school, or what they call middle school now. And it was then that she discovered the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance and the Bible reading, and she was furious because her two sons were going to be taught to honor the country and honor God and to read the scriptures. And you can imagine her fury when she was just denied access to this godless utopian society. And that's what really led to the removal of prayer. Now, remember, she was an outside influence, and the ACLU were outside influences at the time. And all of the attacks on the the entire concept of our God-given rights, not government-given rights, God-given rights, it was from the outside, and it was the government that was defending, the Judeo-Christian establishment and the authority of God in government. What has changed, and what you're discussing today, is the flip-flop. It is the government that is attacking the Judeo-Christian tradition of the country. It is the government that is attacking the authority of God and saying, no, your rights don't come from God. Your rights come from government. They fail to explain that, yes, if your rights come from government, then government can take them away. We have today, for instance, just look at this thing in right now, there Congressman Todd Akin, a wonderful man. If you have listeners in Missouri, I'm saying that Todd Akin is just a great guy, is on the Armed Service Committee, and he added an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill that said that chaplains don't have to participate in same-sex marriages. And Barack Obama has announced, the White House has announced, that they'll veto the entire Defense Authorization Bill rather than allow the chaplains in the military to have their rights of conscience. So now you have a situation where it is the actual governing establishment, the bureaucracy itself, which is challenging and saying we don't want the Judeo-Christian principles, we want that out. And they have a very good reason. They want the authority of God to be replaced with the iron fist of government, and they want to be that fist.
So when you heard Barack Obama talking to Joe the plumber about spreading the wealth around, did part of you go, oh boy, here we go again?
Well, of course, yes. There is no doubt, and I have read a bunch of what Barack Obama has written, including how he pushed around women and used drugs, but that's another issue. At his core, he is a collectivist. And, you can tell by the way he refers to taxing the wealthy. He talks about it in terms of those who have been more fortunate, not those who have worked harder, not those who have created wealth. No, he says those who have been more fortunate. He doesn't view anybody as earning anything. He views everything as that they're more fortunate because our government has done something that has, and therefore we should be able to take their money away from them. He does not view any individual labor. He only views it in collectivist terms. And he thinks he is so smart that he can eventually create this utopian society that everybody will love. And remember what my mother wondered over there. It wasn't just the job and the apartment at virtually no cost and the basic foodstuffs, which is, I understand what destroyed the Soviet Union because I was a dedicated Marxist since I was growing up, and I learned all this to understand Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it was the free medical care. Everybody got free medical care in the Soviet Union. Of course, medical care was virtually non-existent as a result of it being free for everybody. But, why go into that?
Minor detail,
yeah.
Well, it's interesting, especially for some of the younger listeners to hear this, I think, because when an older person talks about, the creeping socialism and, history repeating itself, I think it's, a lot of it is lost on younger people. A story that I tell often on the show is a young lady I was talking to was just out of college, and we were in a group, and someone mentioned communism, and she kind of looked up with that deer in the headlights look and said, okay, communism, that's the bad one, right? And when you have our schools intentionally dumbing down the curriculum to keep our students ignorant of history, these kind of things happen. So we need to hear this. Not just your personal family story, but you know, the context within which all of this was happening from a societal standpoint. It's kind of hard for people to for young people, I think, to put themselves in that mindset of what was going on in our society at that particular time. I have to ask, Bill, did you get a lot of personal attacks? I mean, did other people your age in the schools come up to you and say, you don't believe in God, you're a horrible person, your mother's a horrible person? What kind of personal experiences did you have?
Well, you know, nothing is black and white. Keep in mind, this happened in Baltimore, Maryland, mm-hmm. which was one of the hotbeds of communism. The Longshoremen's Union in Baltimore was and probably still is an offshoot of the World Socialist Workers Party. Baltimore was a radical bed of communism, probably second only to Chicago, Illinois. People think it would be New York, but it wasn't. Chicago and Baltimore were even though the Communist Party had headquarters in New York, Chicago and Baltimore were the two headquarters. And then of course the Longshoremen's Union's out in California, but that, you know, that's a different story. There was a large socialist element there. Now, we happened to have lived at the time in an immigrant type of neighborhood, which we're and this at the time, for the young people out there, immigrant didn't mean it was mostly Hispanic. Most of the immigrants were from Europe. Most of them were from the Eastern Bloc countries in our neighborhood. Most had fled. Most of our neighbors were first generation, or at the most second generation, from Poland, from Hungary, from East Germany, from Russia, from Czechoslovakia, that had managed to escape communism. There were kids that went to school for me that their parents tied them when they were infants to their chests and crawled under barbed wire to get out of communist countries. Are you pretty much getting a view of what this neighborhood was like?
Yes.
And my mother wanted to turn the United States of America into the type of nation that they had escaped from.
Right.
and people think, of course, they think of me, the whole atheism thing, but remember, my mother was the chairman of the Fair Place for Cuba Committee, the manager of the Communist Party bookstore, which, by the way, still exists there. And with those kids that I have a tough time, yes. However, at the same time, in high school, I was the president of the United Nations Club, because that's where all the communists and socialists kids went to. And boy, they revered me because of, you know, what all my family was doing, and they made me president of the United Nations Club.
Bill, I hate to do this, but we are out of time. In the short time we have left, I want to give you a chance to pitch your book and tell folks where they...
Well, My Life Without God, and by the way, I go, it does have the whole history in it, but I did add a final chapter reflecting on some of the utopian things that I talked about today, and discussing how my mother was murdered by one of her employees. They can get My Life Without God just about anywhere. As I said, Kindle, Nook, Amazon, WorldNet Daily site, because WorldNet Daily is a publisher. My site is Religious Freedom Coalition .org. And if they want more information about what I do, they can take a look at that at religiousfreedomcoalition.org.
Fantastic. Bill, thank you for being here today. I've enjoyed your visit very much.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillard.